Good morning and welcome back to the Broadcast Retirement Network. I'm Jeff Snyder and this is BRN Weekly for Saturday, January 16th, 2021. And our top story today, can Japan raise its teleworking game? Joining me now to discuss this and more is Dr. Kenji Chita. He's an independent researcher based in Okayama, Japan. Kenji, great to see you again. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me again, Jeff. It's good to be here.
Yeah, happy new year to you. Great to see you. So in the second wave of the COVID virus, it's currently, I don't know if it's a second wave, third wave, fourth wave, whatever. It's affecting many different countries around the world. Let's focus on Japan first. Let's talk about the reaction, how people are doing, how small business is doing.
Okay. Well, as far as Okayama in particular, I think small businesses have been greatly affected. They're not doing so well. Many of them have been somewhat reliant or making use of the government aid that's been given out. It was given out last year where small businesses and also self-employed people were able to apply for a grant to offset some of the money they lost during the state of emergency as a result of COVID-19. So I would say that small businesses aren't doing very well. I mean, it's just a supply chain situation. So it doesn't matter where you are on it. The flow of resources, income has been disrupted. And people have finally felt it now. Big business and small businesses, but particularly small businesses and those connected to travel, in the travel industry in particular, entertainment, transportation, those types of businesses have been affected the most, I think.
Yeah. Now, Kenji, here in the States, a lot of people have moved to telecommuting, and that is good for people who can do that. They work in an office. They have the ability to, for example, fill orders, do administrative work. That is not always the case for people who actually have to be deliverers of goods, working construction, et cetera. What's that like? What's telecommuting like in Japan? Has that been well received, or is it something that has not been as well received?
I think in the beginning it wasn't well received at all, because part of business culture in this country is about being in the office for extremely long hours, whether you need to really be there or not. It's just something that's expected of people. Whether you're in a company or in an educational institution, it's pretty much the same rule across the board. And it wasn't well received, be it in the corporate world or in education. It wasn't well received, but people did it because it was asked of them by the government. And it was a shock. I don't think it's something people expected to go on forever or last as long as it's had. It has lasted or continue the way it's going to continue. And I mean, I'll give you this is a simple illustration. It was really difficult to even get the equipment you needed to do it. For example, you couldn't, even if you had your own computer or own home internet connection or Wi-Fi, you couldn't get a microphone. You couldn't get, even in Japan, I mean, if you go to the electronic shop, suddenly all the microphones are gone. And the reason is not that there are no microphones or headsets in Japan, it's that the demand for them is quite low. I mean, it's for people who use their computers for recreation, to surf the net or whatever, or maybe gamers, but the large swath of the population just doesn't need it. So the demand is not there. Suddenly the demand was there. If you went to the electronic shop, you couldn't find a headset. So the hardware wasn't even there. It's gotten better now. But a lot of companies have not really adjusted to it very well. I think the one segment of the society that has adjusted pretty well, I think, are educational institutions. By having classes online, they've adjusted. But the concept of people being productive at home as workers for industrial or commercial industries, I think that's still in development. But you know, it's being done. But people are still going to the office. People are still commuting. The traffic is intense, still on the highways and bypasses. So it's not really, especially in Okayama, because I know in other prefectures, especially in up north in the Kanto area, they have the state of emergency where you pretty much have to telework. And also recently in the Kansai area around Osaka, they have a state of emergency now declared. So they have to telework. In places like here in the, we call the Chugoku area, Okayama, it's still not in a state of emergency situation. So people are still going to their offices. Now, these are people who have work to go to. Many people have been, like I said before about the transportation industry, the travel industry, people have been laid off, furloughed. So those people have either they're unemployed or they found other positions doing some other type of work. So, it's been a hard sell. It still is a hard sell because partly just that the culture of telework is not here.
Yeah. And look, I mean, that's the same thing. I think we're all over here in the States. We are over Zoom calls. We are over Skyping with one another. You know, that sense of connection, you don't get that sense of connection. Kenji, let me ask you about here in the States. I think we talked about this when you were last on at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. We passed some legislation here, not me, but the Congress and the president signed into law the CARES Act. And that had some stipulations that allowed people to tap into their retirement funds if they needed it. We have over 10 million Americans that are currently unemployed that are looking for a job. Did the government of Japan do anything similar so that you could have access? I know that when we talk to you, there's a national pension system. It's really
right.
well designed.
Right.
But is there any way right. to tap into that today?
You can't tap into your pension. That's impossible, as far as I know. But what you can do is you can, for given the special circumstances, you can get quite a substantial grant or assistance from the government for your private enterprise or your self-employment situation for 2020. So it can be. So people who are eligible for that are people who lost 50% of their income. And it can be millions of yen, or you can say tens of thousands of dollars. It could really make up for lost earnings. So and people are taking that up. I mean, they're availing themselves of that. I know people who have. People who are in the trades are doing it. That's pretty much the extent of what there is available. Although, you know, there was, and we talked about it before, there was a stimulus type of package that was handed out last year as well, which I thought was substantial for Japan, $1,000 per resident of Japan, citizen or not. But there will not be another one of those. However, as a small business or even medium-sized business or a self-employed person, you can get aid, which is just as good as trying to dip into a pension, which you cannot do in Japan.
Right. And then I guess last question here, Kenji. We've got the vaccine that, you know, from several pharmaceutical companies, I believe, here in the States. It's being distributed, I think, around the world. There's been some hesitancy among some Americans of taking the vaccine, although that has begun to creep up, I think, as people become more comfortable. Maybe they know friends, see doctors, et cetera, other people. What about in Japan? Is that something that people are doing? Do you have access to the vaccine? I mean, not you in particular, but do people in risk groups have access to the vaccine?
Well, yeah, the vaccine is not here yet. The government has announced that it will arrive in February sometime. I think they said at the end of February. Now, who will have access to it first? Who will be prioritized? That hasn't been, I think, clearly stated. And I mean, to answer your question about people's hesitancy, I have some questions about whether people will actually take it because actually, Japan or Japanese people have somewhat of a history of being reluctant to take vaccines. I mean, if you even look at the flu vaccine that was released, I guess a decade ago now, but there were the side effects that were associated with that scared people away. Although there's a large percentage of people who take the flu vaccine every year, a lot of people don't take it or have never taken it and would never take it. I'm one of them. I've never taken it. And I won't take it. And I think the same thing could be said for the COVID-19 vaccine. I think people will be hesitant to take it, and I think one of the reasons is because I don't think there's a clear end game about what is expected to be the result of taking the vaccine. Is it? I mean, if it's just to if it's to protect people from getting COVID-19, and people can understand that, but is the vaccine expected to make it so the economy can resume the way it was, or rebound, or things can go back to normal, travel can go back to, what is expected to happen as a result of the vaccine being administered in the country? And there's no real, I guess, kind of reasoning that's been put out to the people about why they should take it, other than to say, all right, to survive the pandemic, to survive COVID-19, which people, of course, want to do. But there's just a reluctance to get involved with something that could have potentially dangerous side effects, which, of course, people in Japan are very leery of.
Yeah. Well, yeah, certainly I can understand that. Well, Kenji, we're going to have to leave it there. Really appreciate you coming on the program, sharing your perspective, and giving us your analysis. And we look forward to having you back on the program again very soon.
Thanks, and yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kenji. Great to see you. Thanks for sharing your perspective. And when we come back, we'll take a look at some of our best segments of the week. You're going to want to stay tuned right here on BRN Weekly. Imagine a new television network that will make you richer, healthier, and in control of your financial future. This network is for the policewoman in Nashville, Tennessee, the baker in Dubuque, Iowa, the teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. We want to make the idea of savings and retirement culturally relevant. But what do you see as a defining issue of the midterms? Especially for the smaller businesses, I mean, they are the lifeblood of the American economy. Featuring exclusive interviews, current affairs, and docuseries. 33 years old, you retired early.
The philosophy is money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love.
But you gotta start thinking about retirement as soon as you get in.
The Broadcast Retirement Network will drive very high engagement with premium partnerships. So this isn't retirement and savings for your parents or grandparents. This is for all Americans. And we're gonna change the way you think about money. Welcome to the next frontier of retirement and savings. This is BRN, the Broadcast Retirement Network.
Hi, folks. Joe Namath here, and if you're on Medicare, this is important. You're now entitled to eliminate copays and get dental care, dentures, eyeglasses, prescription coverage, in-home aids, unlimited transportation, and home-delivered meals, all at no additional cost. Plus, your zip code may have coverage with the Give Back benefit that adds money back to your Social Security check every month. Look, with the uncertainty of the virus and vaccines, you need to get everything you're entitled to. Here's the bottom line. Call to get significant benefits at no additional cost and see if your zip code has coverage with the Give Back benefit. Millions of people have trusted the Medicare Coverage Helpline. You can too. Call now. It's free.
Call 1-800-924-3920. That's 1-800-924-3920.
Welcome back. On Wednesday, I sat down with the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, Betsy Mayotte, to discuss why you should think twice before refinancing that student loan. Let's take a look.
You know, first I want to explain the difference between refinancing and consolidation, because I think there's some confusion there as well. Consolidation is when you take your individual loans and they get paid off and one great big new loan is created, and that's done in on the federal student loan side. Now, that's different from refinancing, because consolidation doesn't really give you a new interest rate. They do a weighted average of the interest rates of your underlying loans, and then they round up to the nearest eighth of a point. It's more of a way of getting all the loans under a single bill and maybe extending the term. The other reason that federal student loans might want to consolidate is sometimes that's the only way to get access to a particular program. For example, when we were talking about the older borrowers last month, Parent PLUS loans can only get access to an income-driven plan if they do consolidate. Now, refinancing is when you're looking for completely new terms and hopefully you're getting a lower interest rate or a different interest rate. That's only seen on the private student loan side. Now, there are some, federal student loan borrowers that say, oh, look, the interest rates are really good on the private loan side. Maybe I should refinance my federal loans under a private student loan to get this lower interest rate. In almost all cases, that's a terrible idea. The reason it's a terrible idea is doing so means losing access to all your federal protections and benefits, such as public service loan forgiveness, an income-driven plan. If things go south for you financially, you wouldn't be able to get the deferments or other lower payment options that you might be eligible for now under the federal program. Now, if you have private student loans, refinancing can be a great way to lower your interest rate. It's also a way to drop your cosigner. If you have a cosigner on your loan and you want to ameliorate them from their liability of that, then refinancing can be a way to do that. The problem is that a lot of the best deals in refinancing, they're only picking sort of the cream of the crop. Super high credit scores, really good debt to income ratios. They're even looking at what college you went to, whether you graduated, and what you're doing for a living. So it's important to do your research and make sure that you have several options that you're looking at if you're looking to refinance. Depends how you're going about it. There's some services out there that aggregate the different offers. And if you're using like a Credible, for example, if you're using one of those services, they tend not to do a hard pull initially, but when you actually go and fill out the application, they'll do a hard pull. And I forget your other question. I'm sorry.
My question was about My question was about fees. Are there fees associated with doing this?
Usually, there is not a fee for applying for a private loan refinance. There is usually not one. The Biden transition team announced on Saturday, I think, over the weekend, that one of the very first things that he's going to do is to extend the interest waiver and the payment waiver. And we are expecting this to be what we call a clean extension, meaning whatever rules apply right now is what's going to apply when he does the extension. Now, they didn't say how long the extension would be. And the chatter in the industry, the speculation is anywhere. I've heard April, I've heard September, My personal thought is June. I'm putting my money on June that that's what it'll be extended to. First of all, take a look at the interest rates and the terms of the loans you have now. If, you know, I run into people that have asked me about refinancing and their rates are already in the threes. You're probably not going to get much better than that. So is it worth refinancing at all at that point? And then the next is just do your homework. You want to compare the terms that are available for the different lenders. What are they looking for a minimum credit score? Like I said, there are aggregators out there on our website. So we don't promote one lender over another. But what we do, just to make it easier for people, is we list all the private loan lenders that we know of in alphabetical order on our site. So, you know, you could just print that out and use that as your list to start sort of comparing the offers that are available.
And on Thursday, I sat down with Groom Law Group's Kevin Walsh to discuss new Department of Labor guidance around missing participants and beneficiaries. Let's take a look.
So, you know, last night, or if this comes out on the 13th, which it probably won't, but so on January 12th, the Labor Department released new sub-regulatory guidance that talks about missing participants. And that guidance both describes what an investigation looks like. It also describes what DOL believes to be best practices are. And I know in the last segment, I said I loathe the term best practices, but when you're the government, you get to use the term best practices.
Sure.
You know, what this does is it's going to provide some insight for employers in terms of figuring out what the Labor Department's actually trying to get them to do in terms of locating missing participants. They have identified, you know, red flags would be if you have a whole lot of individuals who you don't have birth dates listed for, or if you have a whole bunch of bad addresses, or if you don't have a process for converting returned mail into a need to search. So they've come out and a lot of the things that they're describing here, it's nice to see on paper released publicly, because there are things that we've traditionally only heard DOL ask folks to do one-on-one in an investigation. So on the other hand, what's pretty surprising is there aren't many sites to ERISA in it again. So one could be concerned about, you know, what their basis for a lot of these are. On the other hand, I know I'm on my third hand now. A key to this is they've really laid out, you know, things that plan sponsors and plan fiduciaries would want to think about doing. And they include steps that we've talked about before. You know, are you doing free internet searches? Are you using a paid commercial locator? You know, are you sorting your returned mail to figure out who you should be looking for? Are you periodically auditing your census file, you know, just to have an idea as to, you know, if we try to punch holes in this, is it as good as it looks? And then some of them are a little, I don't want to say zany or out there, but, you know, they also suggest, and this goes back to the privacy segment, I guess, they say that, you know, a plan fiduciary should consider reaching out to the former employee's coworkers to ask if the former employees' coworkers know where the individual lives to update their information. So on the whole, DOL signaling, you know, take a lot of effort, you know, really try to find these people. And I agree with the idea that the retirement system only works if we're able to pay people the benefits that are due to them. On the other hand, you know, we just talked about privacy in the last segment. It seems a little off the wall to reach out to former employees, colleagues, or former employees, former colleagues, in the hope of tracking them down. I, for a certain dollar amount, maybe that makes sense, but I might view that as a little invasive if people reach out to all my former colleagues. Well, and DOL drives home kind of one of the key points, which is that the easiest way to locate missing participants is to not let them go missing or not have them go missing in the first place. And employees and participants can really help with that by updating their addresses when they move, and by, you know, if they've got online access to accounts, using that online access. So Jeff, you made a great point. And, you know, employers can help, but participants themselves can be very helpful here because typically a participant knows where they live.
That wraps up this episode of BRN Weekly. Have a topic of interest, someone you think we should talk to? then drop us a line. And don't forget, for all the information in retirement markets, technology, personal finance, so much more, all in the same place, check out today's edition of The Morning Pulse. We're back again tomorrow for BRN Sunday. I'll be joined by members of the media, academia, and financial services as we analyze all the news for the week. So until then, I'm Jeff Snyder. Stay safe, keep on saving, and don't forget, roll with the changes.
Are you being audited? And do you owe the IRS $10,000 or more in back taxes? Is the IRS threatening to take more of your money? Don't fight the IRS alone. The Tax Doctor is here to help you negotiate your tax bill and reduce your stress. The IRS can freeze your assets and seize your bank accounts, but you can stop these IRS actions. The Tax Doctor will work with you using our years of experience to represent your case to help you get the best resolution under the IRS guidelines. Help is here to deal with the IRS to reduce your stress. We've handled thousands of cases, so we know what we're doing. If you owe $10,000 or more in back taxes, do not call the IRS alone. Call a Tax Doctor now for a tax emergency analysis.
Call 800-224-6439.